Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT. Our guest is Jeff Ashton, who prosecuted Casey Anthony. He has a new book coming out called Imperfect Justice, and he will lecture at MTSU on Thursday, October the 18th at 7 p.m. in the new Student Union Ballroom. He is being presented here by the Forensic Institute for Research and Education. We're going to talk about being the state attorney-elect for the state of Florida. We're going to talk about being a prosecutor, and we're going to talk about the role of scientific advancement in the criminal justice system in the United States. But first, we have a few words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Medieval manuscripts and contemporary creations make up two fascinating new displays in MTSU's James E. Walker Library. The Art of the Page features manuscript leaves from Western Europe to India, and the second exhibit, Crossing Time and Space, features the work of Professor Kathleen O'Connell of MTSU's Department of Art. Both are available for viewing through December. And MTSU alumnus and former U.S. Congressman Bart Gordon has been honored with the designation of officer in the French Legion of Honor for his nearly 30 years of public service. Gordon, now a partner with the law firm K&L Gates in Washington, spent 26 years in Congress representing the 6th District, retiring in 2010. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Mr. Ashton, thanks for being our guest today on MTSU on the Record.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
How would you assess overall the extent to which the criminal justice system in America has been willing to accept scientific advancements in investigating criminal activity?
Well, I think our system really has been pardon me, quite advanced in its attitude toward new kinds of evidence. We do have rules that attempt to restrict the admission of evidence that might not have sort of past the scientific community itself. I mean, we don't want completely speculative scientific evidence. We want science that's been tested in some way in the crucible of publication and scientific journals. But I mean, as far as being open to new types of science, I think our criminal justice system has been pretty advanced in that.
Do you think that the television programs such as CSI and the way movies treat the subject have done justice to the way in which DNA evidence is gathered, the way in which it is stored, and the way in which it is used by attorneys at trial?
Well, I don't really think that the CSI shows in general necessarily, correctly show how it works. Obviously, they're good because it gets people interested in it. We fear sometimes that it raises people's expectations unrealistically, first about whether DNA evidence or in fact forensic evidence of any kind will be available in every criminal case. I mean, not every case is there forensic evidence to analyze, and in the real world, the laboratories don't have the resources to examine DNA on every case. So I think it's made people a bit unrealistic in their expectation. I think also it has made people somewhat unrealistic in believing that science will always be able to solve a question or solve a case. You know, even where you do have science, it doesn't necessarily give you a clear answer. You know, jurors still have to take responsibility for making the ultimate decision of putting all the evidence together and deciding how to use it. So I think it's had some good effect and some bad, but I think people just need to realize, that it's fiction and treat it as such.
Do you think that the public, and after all the jury pool is taken from the public, is more inclined to acquit a defendant if the prosecution has little more than circumstantial evidence to go on because they expect DNA to be the deciding factor?
Well, the interesting thing about that question is that actually DNA is circumstantial evidence. I mean, the only, as a matter of law, fingerprints and DNA and all of those things are all circumstantial evidence. You know, the only thing that really isn't circumstantial evidence is a confession or an eyewitness. So I think people first misunderstand what circumstantial evidence is, But I do think that, that people, again, because of the what we in law call the CSI effect, which is the, you know, the idea of making people expect that evidence, it really has made people perhaps a little bit less able to take responsibility to make the difficult decisions. I mean, it's easy to decide a case when you have a clear piece of forensic evidence showing which way to go. But it's a little harder to take responsibility for making the decision when you have to go into a more complex case. And I think that's another side effect, really, of the whole CSI culture.
As a prosecutor, what is your relationships with criminologists, people who gather evidence at the crime scene, been like over the years?
Excellent. I mean, I we rely on them extensively in what we do every day. And, you know, we couldn't operate without them. And having a good, you know, forensic specialist is essential to any kind of a case. I mean, you want a good forensic specialist and you want an honest one. I mean, one of the biggest fears that we all have, or not fears, but the biggest concerns we all have is, you know, when we see in the newspaper that some forensic specialist has been doctoring reports or falsifying results, or I just saw something on the news within the last week about some drug analyst somewhere in the country that was, you know, falsifying results, and that scares us all, because number one, you know, none of us want that, and number two, it just puts a black cloud on all the honest scientists out there.
Could you describe what the importance of maintaining the chain of evidence and the keys to making sure that the chain of evidence is maintained and that evidence does not become tainted or contaminated?
Well, you know, a chain of custody is a legal concept that has to do with assuring that a piece of evidence is what we think it is. In other words, if we have, let's say, a specimen from a rape case, you know, we want to know that it actually came from where we think it came from, and chain of custody is part of that security. You know, if we know every hand it passed through, then we can know what happened to it. Even in those circumstances, of course, you know, if you have a human being involved in it, then tampering is possible. You know, you can't ever completely prevent somebody from breaking the law and doing something wrong. So in addition to actual chain of custody, you have to have integrity in the participants themselves. I mean, that's essential. And if you don't have that, then you don't have confidence in the outcome of the analyses. And I think that's the most important thing.
We'll be back with more with Jeff Ashton on MTSU on the Record right after this.
The MTSU Educational Talent Search, or METS, reaches out to students in grades 6 through 12 in Coffee, Grundy, and Warren counties. We provide youngsters who have college potential with educational and financial aid counseling and guide them as they determine their educational and career goals. More than 95% of Educational Talent Search students graduate from high school, and more than 79% enroll in post-secondary education. This is METS Coordinator Debbie Frisbee.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking to Florida's state attorney-elect, Jeff Ashton. His new book is entitled Imperfect Justice, Prosecuting Casey Anthony, and the title of his speech that he'll be delivering October the 18th at 7 o'clock on the MTSU campus in the new Student Union Ballroom is A Philosophy Major's Life in Forensic Science. Now, that's counterintuitive as all get out. How did a philosophy major get interested in becoming, a lawyer, I can understand, but
right.
Forensic science?
I've always had a fascination with science, but I was never smart enough to actually be involved in it. I mean, it takes a certain amount of intelligence and thought process and precision to be a scientist. And I just was never smart enough to be able to do that, but yet I always found it fascinating. And I particularly found it fascinating for its potential use in solving crime, because obviously in my career, I became involved in that. In fact, I'd always been fascinated with criminal investigation even before I became a lawyer. So I phrase it that way because I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, you don't have to be a scientist to understand science and understand how to use it and appreciate how to use it. And, you know, by opening your mind to things that are outside of maybe your comfort zone, you actually can do some pretty amazing things.
Did you become interested in forensic science earlier than college, or was it only after you started your higher education career or entered your professional career that it began to interest you?
My fascination with it really came from my actual practice. I mean, I became, you know, interested in newer and better ways to solve, again, problems. You know, a case is always a problem to be solved. So I think I became, you know, involved in it in that way. And it just fascinated me so much that I just always wanted to find new ways to use this fascinating new tool that we had. And so it kind of just developed from that.
How do you feel when you read about a case in which DNA evidence actually freed an innocent person who had spent time enjoying the state's hospitality, shall we say, for years and years of his or her life, and was freed only because the scientific evidence became available?
I mean, that's probably one of the most gratifying parts of having been involved in sort of the birth, if you will, of DNA as an effective forensic tool is how many times it's been used to exonerate people that don't belong there. I mean, I prosecutors sometimes get a bad rap for sort of wanting to confirm their convictions no matter what, but most prosecutors I know, at least most good ones, if new evidence comes in showing that, you know, they got the wrong guy, they're the first ones to jump up and say, hey, you know, we need to correct the injustice. So, you know, the truth is truth, and the great thing about DNA is it's really just pure truth. You know, how you interpret it sometimes is subject to debate. You know, what a particular genetic result means in a particular case is subject to debate, but, you know, it is what it is. The DNA is what it is, so that's the beauty of it.
I understand that you have won convictions in a dozen capital murder cases. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Activists complained bitterly about the electric chair being cruel and unusual, the punishment. And now we have activists complaining that even a lethal injection is cruel and unusual because they say that the effect that the substances injected into the convicted criminal's body are not as benign as we've been led to believe that they are. Could you lend a little clarity to that?
Well, I mean, I'm not. I know that there have been various, you know, activists who want to abolish the death penalty, who, you know, have constantly been asserting that the methods that are used are somehow cruel and unusual, and the Supreme Court to this point has always disagreed. And I think people need to understand that cruel and unusual punishment is a concept that was created at the time of the Constitution. And it really doesn't mean painless. It simply means that the method of punishment should not be cruel and unusual as compared to the crime that's being punished. So I think that you know, for people to say that the lethal injection, which essentially puts somebody to sleep and then gives them a three-drug cocktail, but essentially the person is put to sleep, and then their respiration and heart activity are stopped chemically. That's not, in my opinion, and I think ultimately in the opinion of the court, not cruel and unusual compared to the crime for which they're being punished. You know, there are people out there who would say that true justice would be executing the person by the same method that they used to execute their victim. I don't agree with that, because I don't believe that our society should stoop to that level. But I don't necessarily think that the method of execution has to be completely painless either. I think it simply needs to be appropriate to the crime involved. And I think that the electrocution, when properly performed, is a fairly instantaneous method of death. And I believe that lethal injection is as well. You know, for that matter, a firing squad is a very, you know, physically painless way to die. Obviously, we've moved away from that because, from our perspective, it's certainly not a public spectacle that we want to be involved in. But there are people out there who will always say that the method of execution is cruel and unusual, no matter what it is. So that's a question for them to debate.
When you started out work as a prosecutor with the state attorney's office in Orlando, you prosecuted drunk driving cases. Was drunk driving taken as seriously as it should have been at that time, or was this prior to the creation of Mothers Against Drunk Driving?
When I started prosecuting DUI cases, it was right at the very beginning of the sort of increased sensitivity to drunk driving. So at the very beginning of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving movement. So, you know, from the time that I was a very young prosecutor, DUIs were taken very seriously, and you know, they still are. So I really didn't experience that period in our history where, you know, DUI was considered just a relatively minor matter and dealt with a slap on the wrist. So it's always been serious in my history.
Has the methodology changed in the use of field sobriety test and breathalyzer test since you first started prosecuting?
It has somewhat. I mean, the exact device that's used has been upgraded. It's slightly different. You know, it's more computerized now than it was when I was a young prosecutor in 1981. You know, computers were fairly rare, and now they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. So, I mean, the methodology, that is the technical aspects of it, have changed, but the basic idea of what the breathalyzer does really hasn't. It's doing essentially the same thing. It's just perhaps by different methods. You know, field sobriety tests have become somewhat more sophisticated in the last 30 years, and mainly to the point that officers are just being trained a lot more into how to look at them and what subtle signs to look for, things of that sort.
We'll be back with more with Jeff Ashton on MTSU on the Record in just a moment.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Jeff Ashton is our guest. He's going to speak here on MTSU's campus, the Student Union Ballroom, October 18th at 7 p.m. The topic of his speech will be a philosophy major's life in forensic science. His book is Imperfect Justice, Prosecuting Casey Anthony. I have a colleague who will believe to her dying day that Casey Anthony was guilty, 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 and should be behind bars even as we speak, and that the final verdict was a case of jury nullification. What happened?
Well, you know, it's hard to really say. I mean, we can all have opinions about what happened. In the process of writing the book, you know, I had a lot of time to kind of sit back and try and analyze and figure out why, you know, this particular jury's view of the evidence was so much different than my view and the view of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, it appeared, around the country. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that dichotomy was best explained by the very process of pretrial publicity and jury selection. I mean, when you look back on the case, you know, every single bit of evidence that we had in the case had been vetted publicly over and over again, ad nauseum. It had been the subject of opinions, again, ad nauseum. You know, every show on TV was people expressing their opinions about how guilty she was. And I think through that process, what happened was, oddly enough, that all of those people out there who sort of would have looked at the evidence the way we did, and people we would have wanted as jurors, you know, people that like to put pieces of puzzles together, people that, you know, feel strongly about maternal obligation, you know, those kind of things. Those people, unfortunately, had already been convinced of her guilt by the media. And having been convinced of her guilt, of course, they could not sit as jurors in the case. So what that essentially left us with as jurors were all of those people who, having heard all of our evidence, were not convinced. And when you think of it that way, you kind of come to the conclusion that the state's kind of, you know, dead before it starts, because your jury's already heard your case. and isn't convinced by it. So, you know, I kind of think that's what really happened, is that process simply skewed the jury toward a high level of skepticism instead of having a more balanced panel of, you know, people of all views. So, you know, that's my best explanation for it.
But you've prosecuted cases before that were subject to the intense scrutiny of the 24/7 news cycle. What made this case different from those cases?
You know, I had never been involved in a case that had that level of scrutiny. I mean, there have been cases, you know, in our jurisdiction that got a good deal of local publicity, but this is really the first one that was the subject of this kind of intense attention by what I call the infotainment industry. You know, the sort of the 24-hour news cycle, the CNNs and the HLNs, and those sources of information tend to be much more intense and much more opinion oriented. And so I don't think that we had ever had a case where we had had this level of constant inundation with information. And even in those cases in our jurisdiction where we had had that, we had been able to go to other parts of Florida to pick jurors where the publicity had not been intense. I mean, you know, you could go 100 miles from Orlando. In fact, I'd done that before, and find a jury that maybe had heard about the case slightly but didn't know much about it. Unfortunately, with Casey, that was not possible. There's no place for us to go where we could get away from the publicity.
Why didn't we learn our lesson with prior trials? I say, as Americans, dating back, well, before my time, you know, Leopold and Loeb, Sacco and Vanzetti.
Right.
We're talking about, in my lifetime, Sam Shepard, O.J. Simpson. Why haven't we learned our lesson yet with the impact, or the adverse impact, that some media, not all, can have on the coverage of a trial?
You know, I think we know, I think we've learned the lesson of it, but the problem is that, you know, very appropriately, our First Amendment protections are so strong that people are just, that is, government officials and the rules are such that it's very difficult for us to restrict, you know, what the media says, you know, and I don't think we should. I think it's a good thing that we have a free and open media. The difficulty is that we as a public have not become sophisticated consumers of news, and actually now, you know, with the 20, I mean, you talk about Sam Shepard, you know, back in the days of the Shepard case in the 60s, most people got their news from newspapers. So, you know, once a day you would read an article about the particular case that contained opinions and facts and so on. You know, nowadays, instead of seeing it once a day, you see it 9 times a day, you see it on television, and you see it over and over and over and over again. So it's just a much higher level of inundation with information, and it's much you know, broader range. When you add to that the fact that anyone with half an interest in the case can now go online and read every single bit of information about a case, at least in Florida, that just makes for this incredible media circus that tries cases in the press. And it is bad. It's something that I wish we could change here in Florida, at least maybe by restricting what we give out to the media.
What is your opinion on cameras in the courtroom?
You know, I don't think cameras in the courtroom are a bad thing, because I think people watching the actual trial is a very good thing, because people, they, through that process, they get the information filtered through the rules of evidence, which is the way it should be. You know, when you're watching a trial, there are certain rules that keep you from getting certain kinds of unreliable information, and that's a good thing. Unfortunately, we don't have those restrictions in the press. So, you know, in the press, you get everything unfiltered, and in the courts, you get it filtered. So I actually think it's better that people can watch actual trials, because I think they learn from that. And, you know, they can come to opinions based upon facts that, you know, the law has filtered with the rules of evidence.
You don't hold with the opinion that some have, that attorneys will be more likely to grandstand with cameras in the courtroom.
you know, we're hams anyway.
That's
we're
what
grant
I figured.
That. I mean, I'll be honest with you. In any trial, we have an audience of 12. And while you know, there may be some lawyers that will have a bit more of a dramatic flourish for the cameras. You know, the reality of it is that those drama queens are going to be drama queens no matter whether the camera's there or not. They're going to be that way in front of a jury anyway. So I don't really think that that's a bad thing. I mean, to the extent that that might happen, I think the danger of that is much less than the value we get from jurors seeing actual trials.
We'll take one more brief break, and we'll be back with more with Jeff Ashton on MTSU on the Record in just a moment.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking to Jeff Ashton. His speech is entitled A Philosophy Major's Life in Forensic Science, and it's free and open to the public Thursday, October the 18th at 7 p.m. in the new Student Union Ballroom on the MTSU campus, presented by our own Forensic Institute for Research and Education. What do you want to get across to the young people you'll be speaking to who want to go into the criminal justice arena, whether they are pre-law, whether they want to be criminologists, whether they want to be coroners? What is the main point that you want to get across to these young people? There'll be others in the audience, of course, but the college students who will be looking to you as a working professional for some kind of direction.
I hope, you know, to get them or to increase their enthusiasm for going into professions that in law enforcement or forensics or law, because it is so fascinating. I mean, that's one of the sort of the purposes of the title, is to say to people, look, you know, you don't have to be a scientist to find this fascinating and to get involved in this, because the more people are involved in it, the more advances we'll get. I mean, there are amazing areas of research that haven't even been touched upon yet that can revolutionize forensic science. Now, I don't know that there'll ever be anything to revolutionize forensic science quite like DNA, because it was just a once in a millennium kind of thing. But there are other areas where forensic science can give us truth, because it is one of the purest forms of truth if it is done properly, and I think it's exciting to get people involved in that.
When do you take the oath of office?
January 8th will be my first day. my first day.
Well, congratulations to you, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Jeff Ashton, he'll be speaking, as I said, October the 18th at 7 p.m. in the new Student Union Ballroom here at MTSU, and the address is free and open to the public. Thanks again, Mr. Ashton. It's been
a
pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.